Verse 7, we had read verse 8 through 16. That will be our text this morning. There once was a man, the story goes, who was abnormally jealous. He was fearful regarding his money, and all his life, every time he got a paycheck, he took $20 out and he put it under his mattress. And after many years of this, he would add more and more to the $20. So he had quite a sum that he had collected. But it wasn't too long in his life before he got sick. And it became very clear that he was going to die, and he was going to die soon. And as he was laying there, literally on his deathbed, he kept thinking about all of the money that he had saved and had never gotten to spend. And the bitterness began to eat away at his soul. And no matter what solution he thought of, somebody else was going to use his money. So he came up with a solution, that he wrote up a document and he presented it to his wife, and he pressured her to sign a contract which stated that once he was dead, his wife would put his money into the casket with him so that he could take it with him. Well, obviously that became a source of conflict between the two of them. But he was so persistent that his wife finally agreed to sign the contract so that he could die in peace and the last few days together would not be a bitter fight. And after the man died, do you think his wife kept her promise? She went to the bedroom, got all of the money that was under the mattress. She took it to the bank and deposited it. Then she wrote a check for the full amount and put it in the casket with her dead husband. What do you think? Did she keep the covenant or did she break the covenant? Nobody wants to answer, do they? Letter of the law. Letter of the law. Regardless of how you decide that should have gone or whether or not you want to answer that actual question, when we come to the text of Scripture, we begin to, or we continue to have to wrap our minds around the covenant that Israel was involved in. And the question that I'm presenting to you is a simple one. What covenant did Israel break? Look with me in Hosea chapter 6 and look at verse number 7. Hosea chapter 6, verse 7. We had talked about this particular passage a little over a week ago. I think 2 weeks ago, didn't we? Is when we covered this. And in verse 7 it says, "But they, like men, have transgressed the covenant." We talked about how that was like Adam or Adam. I'm not going to go back and revisit that, but I just want to draw attention to that simple concept where they have transgressed the covenant. And then look at verse or chapter 8, verse 1 of Hosea. It says, "Set the trumpet to thy mouth. He shall come as an eagle against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law." So here, clearly, in this area, and you remember where we're at in the story of the book, that Hosea here, what's happening is God is presenting to Israel how Israel has been unfaithful. And in the midst of that, this key concept of breaking the covenant keeps coming up. It's here that we would expect to find it if it happened. And the question is really, what covenant did Israel break? And I would suggest that the covenant that they broke was the Sinai covenant. Let me put it to you a different way. It was the covenant that God made with Moses and the children of Israel. You say, what does that mean? Well, you've heard of the Ten Commandments. That's the Sinai covenant. That's a synopsis, a summary of the Sinai covenant. But what you need to understand is that the Sinai covenant, the covenant that God made with the people of Israel through the law of Moses, that it was a conditional covenant. In other words, God said, if you do this, then I will do this. But if you do this, then I will do this. And he made it very clear to them that if they obeyed him and they followed him and they listened to what he had to tell them, then he would bless them. And if they disobeyed him, that obeyed God, if they broke the covenant, what would he do? Not bless, but curse. That he would curse them. And so he laid it out very clearly for them. In fact, if you want to look at this passage with me, leave a marker in Hosea 7. We will, of course, return there. But I want to just open your eyes to this. Look at Exodus chapter 34. Many times this covenant is described. Many times it is laid out. And the conditional nature of it is over and over and over again demonstrated. But in Exodus chapter 34, we see this happen very clearly. I'm going to fly through this passage. So if you want to do further study on it, just mark down where it is. And you can look at it throughout the week. Exodus chapter 34, verse number 1. And the Lord said unto Moses, hew thee two tables of stone. Make two tables of stone like unto the first. Remember what happened? The first 10 commandments, two table stones. He came down off Mount Sinai. And all the people were involved in immorality. And he took the stone tablets, the Ten Commandments, and he shattered them. Now he's back up on Mount Sinai. And God is saying, make two more. Right? So I didn't know the Ten Commandments was written twice. It was. So here it is. And I will write upon these tables the words that were in the first tables, which thou breakest. And be ready in the morning and come up in the morning into Mount Sinai. And present thyself there to me in the top of Mount Sinai. Skip down to verse 4. And he hewed two tables of stone, like unto the first. And Moses rose up early in the morning and went up into Mount Sinai. Verse 5. The Lord descended in a cloud. Verse number 6 and 7. He proclaims his name. Verse 8. We have Moses' response. He bowed his head towards earth and worshipped. In verse number 9, he asked him a request. He asked something of God. He says, if now I found grace in thy sight, O God, O Lord, O Yahweh, let my Lord, I pray thee, go among us. Isn't that an interesting request? So here's what Moses says. He says, if I found grace in your sight, God, then do one thing for me. What was it? Go among us. Live with us. Be a God who dwells presently with our nation. That's what he's asking. That's what he's seeking for. That's what he wants. Verse number 10 is God's response. And he said, behold, I will make a covenant before all thy people. I will do marvels. Such has not been done in all the earth, in any nation. And all the people among which thou art shall see the work of the Lord, of Yahweh. For it is a terrible thing that I will do with thee. And terrible in the sense of awe-inspiring. That he says, I'm going to make a covenant. And I'm going to show you marvelous things. Verse 11. Observe thou that which I command thee this day. Behold, I drive out before thee the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Different nations. I'm going to drive them out before you in the land of promise, in the land of Canaan, in Israel. Take heed to thyself, lest thou make a covenant with inhabitants of the land, lest it be a snare. But verse 13, what? You shall destroy their altars, break their images, cut down their groves. Verse 14, thou shalt worship no other God, for the Lord, Yahweh, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. Verse 15, he says, lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go a-whoring after their gods, and do sacrifice unto their gods, and one call thee, and thou eat of his sacrifice, and thou take their daughters unto thy sons, and their daughters go a-whoring after their gods, and make their sons go a-whoring after their gods. Thou shalt make no molten gods. And he continues on to lay out the different things that they should do, the different parts of the covenant. And if you notice in verse 28, he summarizes it all at the end. It says he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did neither eat bread nor drink water. And he wrote upon the tables the words of the covenant, the 10 commandments. Now, in many other places, we see this demonstrated as well, and it's fleshed out even more. But ultimately, what's happening in Exodus 34 is God makes a covenant with Moses and the people of Israel, and it is full of blessing and cursing. In fact, when they entered into the land, you know what they had to do? They had to go between two mountains. And what God did is he took a bunch of people, the Levites, and he put them up on Mount Gerizim. And he said, I want you to read out as the people pass by this mountain. I want you to read out on Mount Gerizim. I want you to read out the blessings of the covenant. And then on the other mountain that they pass between, he said, I want you to read out the cursings of the covenant. So you have Gerizim and Ebal, and you have all of the Levites that were on there, and they were reading out what would happen to the people of Israel if they were faithful to the covenant, they would be blessed, and what would happen to the people of Israel if they were unfaithful to the covenant, they would be cursed. So this was not a contract that God made in the dark of night. This was not a promise that he made and they weren't sure exactly what it looked like. They knew exactly what God asked of them and they agreed to it. This is a covenant that God is coming to unfaithful Israel with. So put this in the whole context of Hosea and Gomer. You remember Hosea is a prophet and his wife Gomer was unfaithful to him. And so the book of Hosea starts out with that story like we've talked about. And Hosea made a covenant with Gomer. So do we. Every time that we participate in a marriage ceremony, what is the focus of the ceremony? The vows. The vows. The covenant. And so Israel made a vow to God. What was it? The Sinai covenant. And now they were breaking it. They were being unfaithful. They were committing spiritual adultery. And God was saying, I want you to return to me, but you need to understand what is happening, why you are doing what you are doing. Now, let's just pull back and ask that question. How then does this apply to us? Are we under that covenant with God? You say, you know what, Pastor? I don't remember signing up for the Sinai covenant. me either. We didn't sign up for the Sinai covenant. That covenant was fulfilled by Jesus Christ. Remember when Jesus came? He said, I came not to abolish what? The law, but to fulfill it. What was he fulfilling? The Sinai covenant, the law of Moses. He was fulfilling it. And so the church is not under that covenant. And so you say, okay, so then what does this Hosea passage have anything to do with my life? I'm glad you asked. It has a lot to do with our life. You know, Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11, in chapter 10, where he has, you know, 5 or 6 Old Testament references and examples, he says, now all these things happened unto them for examples. The idea is they were examples for us. And they are written for our admonition, so that we might learn them, upon whom the ends of the world are come. What was Paul saying in 1 Corinthians 10? He is saying all of the Old Testament is there for you to learn. It's not that you can directly apply, in some senses, and in Hosea this is the case, but he said there are some principles there that are meant for you to learn by them. So what do we want to learn from this passage? Can I simply present this? Why did Israel break the covenant? Why did they do it? And I want us to examine 3 reasons why Israel broke the covenant. 3 things that they needed to stay away from. For us as a church, this is the same thing as asking how. How do we maintain a right relationship with God? Here is Israel. God had set up a covenant, a promise with them. They had wed themselves to God. How are they going to maintain that relationship? Why did they break that promise? And I would say, dear friend, as a New Testament believer, you say, what can I walk away from? I'd like to present this, that some of the same reasons that Israel ended up breaking their relationship with God, we can be susceptible to that. That we too might break our relationship with God because of those same problems, those same issues. And so here is Israel breaking the covenant. Why? First of all, because Israel embraced the people of unbelief. Look at Hosea chapter 7, verse number 8. And let's just break this down, the passage with me. You have there verse number 8 through 10. That's going to be our first point. And then verse number 11 through 13 will be our second point. And verse number 14 through 16 will be our last point. So you can follow along in your Bibles. You'll be able to see these fleshed out for you. Israel embraced the people of unbelief. He starts out in verse number 8 by saying Ephraim, and I just want to remind you that Ephraim was one of the, or maybe the premier, one of the premier tribes of Israel. And so it stood as an example of all Israel. And so he says, Ephraim, he hath mixed himself among the people. Ephraim is a cake not turned. Say, what is he talking about them? Let's put it this way. Israel was mixed up. That's the metaphor that he uses. It's a good one. When you take one ingredient and you mix it with another ingredient, what do you get? Well, a mixture. Not a trick question. And many times those mixtures are good, right? But when you make that mixture, if you're trying to keep something pure, then the very act of mixing it is enough to destroy that purity forever. And what God commanded to the people of Israel was that when they came into the land, that what they needed to be certain they did not do was to mix themselves up with the people of the land. That they wanted to be careful that they did not marry their sons to the daughters of foreign nations. And he said, was God racist? Because that sounds awfully racist. And I would say the issue was not so much what race they were, but rather what love they had. Let me put it to you this way. God was concerned that they loved him. In other words, you had other races that could become part of Israel. All they had to do was love God. That was the issue. That was what he didn't want to get mixed, was a faithfulness to God. And he says, don't mix yourself up with people who do not love God. Don't become involved with them. Don't spread your families out among them. Don't allow them to become part of you. Because why? Because that then you will not have the strength of purity. And so he points out to them that Ephraim has done exactly this. By the way, that passage that we just read in Exodus chapter 34, did you catch how he said, I'm going to come in, I'm going to drive out all of the nations? And you heard all the ites, right? The Amorites, the Hizzurites, the Perizzites. So I'm going to remove them all. Why? Because he did not want Israel to mix together with them. This was part of their problem. So verse 8, he says, he hath mixed himself among the people. Ephraim is a cake not turned. Not only was Israel mixed up, but Israel was half-baked. And this, again, is a great metaphor. You know, that is there. And of course, there's an intentional play on words, right? So Israel was like a loaf of flatbread. And what do? When you take that loaf of flatbread and you put it into a fire and you allow those coals to heat it, and if you don't have the convection oven, right, that spread the heat all around, then what's going to happen? The bottom side, and for some of you, this is you know, the solution, or this is what happens with the pizza that you make, right? The crust becomes what? Really crusty. And the top becomes what? Well, it ain't yet done. And so you say, but I can't cook it anymore. Because all it's going to do is make the crust harder. You say, well, you either you need to come up with a different solution. For them, what was the solution? Turn it over. Of course, that doesn't work with pizza. And I'm not going to try to figure out what's wrong with the way you make pizza, right? So you have to figure that out. But for them, here's a loaf of bread that became hard and crusty on the bottom, but it was soft and doughy on the top. It was uncooked. And what's his point? It lacked complete cooking. It lacked the consistency that was there. And so you pull that bread out of the oven and you say, but I don't even want to eat that bread. And what's it good for? Throwing it aside. And so here is God pointing out to Israel through Hosea. He is saying, listen, because you have mixed up with all of these people who do not love me, and because you have been willing to allow them to influence you, you have become mixed up and half-baked. They're even described in verse number 9. He says, strangers have devoured his strength, and he knoweth it not. That they took these, you know, people who didn't love God, and they intermingled them within the nation of Israel. And because of that, their strength was bled out of them, and they didn't even know it. He says that in verse number 9, he says, yes, gray hairs are here and there upon him. And we get that picture, don't we? That they were sprinkled with gray. Why? Because their strength had left them. This is a demonstration of weakness and a loss of youth. So remember, this is the great nation of Israel. Remember King David? Do you remember King Solomon? Do you remember how powerful the nation of Israel was? When what? When it followed God. But now it mixed itself up with the foreign nations. It broke the covenant that God had said, do not break. And because of that, what was it good for? To be cast aside. And yet, what does God say? Verse 10, he said, the pride of Israel testifies to its face, and they do not return to Yahweh, their Elohim, nor seek him for all of this. They do not come back to me. Now, what does that look like for the New Testament believer? What about us? Let me turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. You may turn there with me if you keep a marker in Hosea, or you can just listen. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse number 14, lays out for us a similar principle. Paul writes to the church at Corinth. He says, be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel, one that doesn't believe? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God hath said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Do you notice the connection back to that Sinai covenant? Remember how Moses asked for one thing? He said, I want you to live with us, dwell with us. And Paul is pointing out that that's exactly what God desires to do in the hearts of every believer. Verse 17, wherefore, come out from among them and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you. So here's part of the point, that for Israel, the reason they needed to turn away from these and come back to God is because God is pure. And he cannot accept sin. You say, well, then God could never accept me. And I would say, dear friend, that is why Jesus Christ came. Because God could never accept me either. That without a Savior to save me from my sins, then I would never see eternity. Not in heaven. Not in heaven. And so we must remember that this call to come back to God is a call to abandon our sinful ways and surrender ourselves to the Lord. And so it's repeated. This concept is repeated in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, as we read. And it becomes, or it contains, a principle that we must not ignore. And what is that? It must mean something, right? It has to mean something in your life. In other words, when you consider this principle, when you consider 2 Corinthians, when you consider Hosea, the question is, what exactly does it mean? What are the boundaries, Pastor, of how much mixing is allowable and how much shouldn't be done? Should I have nothing to do with people who don't love God, or should I have a little bit to do with people who don't love God? And where do I draw that line? And I'm going to first of all point out that it must mean something. In other words, friend, I think you're ignoring it to your own peril if it has no difference on your life. That if you're living your life as if this principle did not exist, then you're missing its point. Clearly, you're not obeying it. If it makes no difference to you how you live your life, does it have something to do with amount of time? And I would say, I think it would have to. Does it have something to do with direction? What direction are they going? Yes. Does it have something to do with values? Does it have something to do with intention and building of relationships? Say yes. Somebody just asked you that question. What are you doing to keep yourself from being unmixed? I'm not saying that you can completely stay away from people who don't love God. In fact, that's not how Jesus lived. Amen? But at the same token, Jesus was able to live among people who were not interested in God, and at the same time, he was able to turn their hearts towards him and maintain that focus himself. Now, say, friends, that's our challenge. That's what we are after. Jesus, in his life, spent time with those who were not interested in God and did not love God for the purpose of turning their hearts towards God. But who did he spend most of his time with? Oh, the disciples. People who were interested in following God. And I'll say we have to wrestle with that. We have to at least be willing to acknowledge that and to recognize that. So I would suggest this way. The first lesson we learn from this is that we must love God so much that another's relationship with God affects our relationship with them. Now, I want you to think through that statement with me. Notice the motive here. We must love God so much that that's our motive. That's why we make our relational decisions. When you consider the people that you have included in your life, have you thought about the question, what does God want me to do in that relationship? If you haven't, then you're not even beginning to address this. Because it has to start with that understanding of God has a design for the relationships in my life. Which relationships? All of them. We must love God so much that another's relationship with God. In other words, I look at their relationship with God and I recognize that their relationship with God is going to affect my relationship with them. Does that mean that I have nothing to do with them? No. No. Hear me. No. It doesn't mean that I'm going to approach that relationship differently. Yes. Why? Because I'm concerned so much about God. I want Him to be the ruling factor in my life. So this is our first lesson that we learn. Second, that we find here, we're answering that question, why did Israel break the covenant? Number one, Israel embraced the people of unbelief. Number two, Israel engaged in the hope of unbelief. How can we maintain faithfulness to God? First of all, don't be unmixed. Don't be mixed in. In other words, I think I said that wrong. Don't be mixed in. But secondly, Israel engaged in the hope of unbelief. Look at verse number 11. It says, Ephraim is like a silly dove without heart. They call to Egypt. They go to Assyria. When they shall go, I will spread my net upon them. The idea of this dove or a pigeon, I couldn't figure out which one it was. But this idea of a dove or a pigeon, it was a bird not known for wisdom. That much we know. That's what really drives me towards a pigeon. When you think about a pigeon, what do you think about? Well, silliness. When you think about a dove, what do you think about? Well, not so much silliness, but anyway. And the words aren't helping me in the Hebrew, but nonetheless. Here is Israel, and in its struggle for survival in its last two decades, Israel would run back and forth between different powers. Remember, we had Assyria, the major world power. We had Egypt, a major world power. But we also had Syria, not Assyria, but Syria in Damascus, just to the north. Even Philistia, the Philistines. Let me just, and I know this is historical stuff, but King Menahem, who reigned from 752 to 742 of Israel. He had submitted to Assyria and he had paid Tiglath-Pileser III. He had paid him a lot of tribute. So he had connected himself to Assyria, that world power that would have been to the northeast. But then along comes Pekah. And Pekah assassinated Menahem's son, Pekahiah, right? Thanks for having similar names. And he opposed Assyria. In league with Syria, Damascus. And so he chose not Assyria, but rather the northern Syria, Damascus. And he sought also alliance with Egypt. So like a little bird, he goes over here to Assyria, and then they bounce over here to Damascus, and then they're down to Egypt. But then along comes Hoshea, King Hoshea. He kills Pekah, and suddenly you shift from an alliance with Egypt and Philistia and Damascus, and he goes back to Assyria. And then the Assyrians capture much of the north and everything seems to be fine there. But then they become so powerful that then they go full circle back to Egypt. So you get the picture, right? It's like a little pigeon that is dodging away from whatever harm that they see. That's the idea. They were jumping from one danger to another. They were not considering their path. They were only reacting to the present peril. And so rather than acting with wisdom and foresight, they just responded and reacted. You know, what would it have taken for them to act wisely? Can I suggest this? they would have needed to remember and understand the covenant that God had made with them. God had said, if you follow me, I will bless you. But rather than remembering that covenant, the Sinai covenant, the law of Moses, rather than remembering that, they were just responding to immediate threats. They were saying, well, we can't ally with them because they're getting too powerful. We got to go down here. But then these guys really are kind of powerful and they're really close. So we got to go back over here. Rather than saying, God knows the end from the beginning and he will protect us. They put their hope in other things. They would have needed to embrace that covenant, abide by its term, place their hope in Yahweh, and not in the only hope that unbelievers can embrace. Because you say, what is the only hope that people who do not believe in God can embrace? And I would say, what this world offers. The strategy that this world uses. The power of the might. Or the power of the strong. Or perhaps mercy at times. Or perhaps appealing to some sort of conscience. But ultimately, it's all that this world offers. It's not a life of faith. And instead, notice what happens. God fulfills his covenant with them. He would have fulfilled it if they had obeyed. He would have blessed them. But they disobeyed him, so he fulfilled their covenant. What did it look like? Verse 12, he said, I'll spread my net upon them. I'll bring them down as the fowls of heaven. I will chastise them as their congregation hath heard. He says, I've told them this before. I've made this clear, that if you disobey me, I will curse you. Why? To bring you back. So that you recognize that you should obey. That's his point. That's what he's after. That is what he seeks. Now, what can we learn from this? First of all, I would suggest that we must act with sense and not react. Act with foresight and not react. That God has not promised, indeed it would seem contrary to his plan, he has not promised a carefree, unchallenged life. But God has designed a life for you by his own making. And what he desires for you to do is to not be like a pigeon that just bounces away from challenges or danger or difficult times because all you're interested in is freedom from danger, but rather to act like someone who has a covenant with a God who says, God has a plan for me and I want to embrace that plan and I want to trust him in the midst of it. That even if it includes difficult things, I'm going to operate by faith. Your purposes must flow from his charge to the church. Where he says, go out and make disciples. And so if all that you're looking for in this life is to be free from trouble, your best life now, if that's all that you're looking for, can I suggest to you that you're missing the God of Hosea? Because what he is saying is, I have designs for you. I have purposes for you. I have a plan for you. And I want you to follow and embrace my plan. And are there going to be challenges and difficulties? Of course. But the trajectory is clear. God's movement is in front of us. But if you're embracing the hope of those who do not believe in God, then you're seeking the same thing that they seek. You're scared by the same things that scare them. You trust in the same solutions that they trust. Because there is nothing else for you. So the first lesson that we saw is we must love God so much that another's relationship with God affects our relationship with them. Secondly, I would suggest this. What we must learn is that we must see God so clearly that he is the one that defines our hopes. I just want to help us think it through. We must see God so clearly that he is the one that defines our hopes. Part of Israel's problem is that they had lost their vision of God. They had lost the fact that God had given them a covenant. They had lost that maybe not so much understanding, but belief. And so they didn't see him clearly. And so what did they see clearly? All of the danger that surrounded them. The strong Assyria, the strong Egypt, the very near and present danger of Syria, Damascus. And they were like bouncing from pinball to pinball, afraid of the danger that was around them, rather than seeing God so clearly that they allowed him to define their hope. And what does that look like in your life? Hey, dear friend, can I point out that with this type of understanding, you can enter into financial hardship and not be afraid? that with this type of understanding, you're able to address some of the more difficult things of life. What do you do when a loved one dies? What do you do when you get the message from the doctor that somebody who is very close to you has that terrible C word? What do you do when the difficult things of life are in front of you? And friend, if all you're trying to do is to bounce from danger to danger and find the spot where, you know what, I'm safe, then you're like a pigeon that is silly, like Israel, that is silly and without sense. And God is calling to you and He is saying, listen, I have a plan, I have a purpose, and I want you to embrace it. And you say, then will I be free of my problems? You're missing the point. Then you will live in the presence of God. You see the difference? That what God has for you can only be found in His presence. And there is fullness of joy. Not happiness, temporarily defined, but joy. But joy. Thirdly, why did Israel break the covenant? They embraced the people of unbelief. They engaged in the hope of unbelief. Thirdly, Israel employed the tools of unbelief. Verse number 14 says, and they have not cried unto me with their heart when they howled upon their beds. Boy, that's a really great image, isn't it? You can see the Israelites, and they're weeping and wailing on their bed. They're kicking their feet. They're screaming and they're saying, God, save us. But yet they are not actually interested in God saving them in order for them to follow Him. They're interested in God saving them in order to get what they want. You know, as a parent, we see this in our children, don't we? I remember one time when we stopped at, it was either McDonald's or a Burger King, and we had gotten, you know, supper. And the kids asked if they could have ice cream. And I was feeling a bit like that miser in the opening illustration. Felt like, wait, it's been enough. So I said, no ice cream. And it was amazing to me. The kids then responded with this concept. Can you believe this? The audacity. They responded with this concept. They said this. They said, we are going to cry unless you give us ice cream. Oh, you are. So you're like upping the ante. If I don't give you ice cream, you're going to cry. You think that'll bother me? So tell you what, you do that, and I'll think of what I can do to make it higher. And we'll just keep doing this until one of us finally stops. And they didn't think that was such a great idea. But do you recognize that sometimes we do that with God? That we come to God and we say, God, I want you to give me what I want, and so I'm going to yell and scream at you. I'm going to be upset with you. I'm going to throw my temper tantrum until you give me what I desire. And it's more ludicrous, more ridiculous than that illustration I just gave you. Because, friend, what God is offering to you, to me, is Himself. Not just His gifts, not just good things that this world offers, but Himself. That you don't know, we don't know, enough of what to even ask for. That what God is saying is He is saying, come to me and I'll restore that covenant. Now, He's not saying that to the church, but that's what He's saying here. He's saying to Israel, I will give you all of the blessings. But what are they doing? Verse 14, He says, they cried unto me with their heart when they howled upon their beds. They assembled themselves for what? Corn and wine. That's what they're after. Say, we're gonna raise a ruckus until you give us our corn and our wine because that's really what we want. And God says, you don't know what you want. What you want is me. I'm the best for you. My presence is everything. I will solve all of your problems, but you must be willing to come to me entirely. Be faithful to me. I'll be faithful to you. But they say, give us the corn! Are you serious? That's what you want? So we see these insincere vows that are there, and truth be told, this is a very human thing, isn't it? This is exactly what we do. Now we come to God and we say, Lord, I'm spinning around in my car. I'm on the highway. If you save me right now and don't let me die, I'll serve you forever. And what we really want is just out of that danger. Rather than saying, Lord, I want to serve you forever. I want to live in your presence. I don't want you doing my will. I want to do your will. That's what I'm after. But I want you, God. I want to submit myself to your life. This is what he is saying to them. In verse number 16, he points out, they return, but not to the Most High. They are like a deceitful bow. The imagery there, again, is great. They're like a faulty bow and arrow that when you pull it back and you shoot it, he says it goes, it returns, but not upward, not Godward, not to the Most High. And the idea of the faulty bow is that when it doesn't work, not only does it not go where it's supposed to, but it usually hurts the guy pulling it. And so here is the concept that he's laying out for them, and he's saying, that's what you are like. That you say you want to come back to me, but you're not in earnest. So we have the insincere vows, but also the inept imaginations. In verse number 15, it says, though I have bound and strengthened their arms. And I think that's a Hebrew idiom for raising them up. In other words, he's talking about him building them up as a child. That what he's doing is he is as a father to a son. He has built them up. Though I have raised you, yet do they imagine mischief against me. Even though God brought them out of Egypt, even though he took them from just trotting and making bricks out of clay or making mud bricks in the mud pits, even though he took them out of them and brought them through the wilderness and brought them to the land of promise, but even though he did all of those things and worked in marvelous ways and even made a covenant with them, they still, their imaginations were turned against him. And so they imagined mischief against him. They're like a son that grows up in his father's home. And the whole time he is taking all the good things that his dad has given to him and he is pretending like they're worthless and he's thinking of how he can get even with his dad, even though all that his dad has done ever has been good. And so that when he walks out that final day, he has nothing but bitterness in his soul. And he said, well, I can imagine there might be some dads that deserve that right. But what God is pointing out is here's a dad who has done nothing but good, and yet their son has still imagined it. You know what, dear friends, that resonates with my soul. All that God has ever done to me has been good. It is more than I deserve. You say, well, wait a second. I didn't get as much as the next person. I say, friend, that's not the comparison. That if you want to compare yourself, I can give you all kinds of people in third world countries to compare yourself to. And God has blessed you immeasurably more than them. The very fact that you are sitting in a church that is using the Word of God is a demonstration of His blessing to you. And yet in the midst of that blessing, do we return to God? Or do we try to use the tools of unbelief? I put it this way. What we must learn, I got rid of the first what and the second two, sorry about that. What we must learn is that we must believe God so fully that we use His methods in our problems. What was the problem that the Israelites had there? They were seeking the wrong methods. They were seeking this howling upon their bed as if that would somehow force God to do something. They were using their imagination to concoct mischief to be able to get their own way. That this is what they were doing. In essence, they were saying, we can do better than Yahweh. And God is saying, no, you can't. You must turn back to me. So is that possible for us? Friend, are you tempted to use different methods to get your own way? Or are you seeking to live life according to God's terms? Here are those three questions, those three emphases before you. Can I just ask you to examine your life? Do you love God so much that you view relationships from that standpoint? That a pertinent question whenever you are involved in a relationship issue, a pertinent question is, what's their relationship with God? And how does God want me to respond to that? What about the second? Do you see God so clearly that He is the one who is your hope? that when you look around and look for solutions, when you look to say, where can I find some hope, some reason to move forward, that it becomes God and His purposes? Or how about the third? Do you believe God so fully that you are using His methods in your problems? You understand that to use the methods of this world, to use the wisdom of this world, really, dear friends, what that is it's you're using weapons of unbelief. That you're trying to solve, can I say it this way? You're trying to solve spiritual problems with earthly means. And it's impossible. You're going to find yourself in the same situation as Israel. Let me summarize it all by giving you the proposition. If we determine to obey the commands of God, we must delight in the person of God. Friend, do you want to obey the commands of God? Then how are you doing with God's person? Let's close with a word of prayer. We thank you, Father, for your word.